3 a.m. Tales of Terror contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, and welcome to 3 a.m. Tales of Terror, by the way, because I don't think I said that last time, that this is...
You just assumed people knew who we were?
Yeah, I did. I'm Jamie.
I'm Kenny.
And Eli's still here with us.
Yes, he is. It's our Siamese cat, by the way, if anybody wants to know.
Yes. Also, before I get started, on the last episode, because it's been so long, I thought that I still had the... professional email, like with the domain and everything, and I do not. Wix is, they're killing me. And then it's not just Wix. Like, I paid for Wix, but then like Google has like this admin thing that you have to log into to get the domain, and I can't get into it.
Interesting.
So I don't have the email that is info at 3amtalesofterror.com. So I made just a normal Google one. So, which is going to suck if you listen to old episodes first, but the new email is literally just3amtalesofterror@gmail.com. That's it. So, and I have it on my phone, so you can email if you have any questions, comments, story ideas, all the stuff. I'll repeat it at the end. I just wanted to put it out there because I do not have the info at 3amtalesofterror.com anymore.
You don't have the info anymore?
No, I don't have the info anymore. I also don't have the website, so, and we only have Instagram and Facebook, which is where I will post pictures for the episode, so you can see all of that. So now that that's out of the way, so last night we went to Paranormal Cirque.
Three.
The third one. And so Paranormal Cirque is Cirque Italia, and it's all Italian people who do, like, Cirque du Soleil stuff, but it's paranormal. It's very, very provocative, adult-themed stuff, so just...
Those Italian women had no right to be that hot.
They really didn't, but, I mean, I was okay with it. So...
All the married men, completely quiet, except for, like, a handful that were like, nah, man, it ain't happening.
Yeah. So, in honor of going there last night and having such a great time, I had put together some haunted stories from Italy. So, we're gonna do those for this episode, since... We went and saw a bunch of Italian people last night. Had a great time, by the way. I do highly recommend it if it ever comes to your town.
Yeah, for the price.
Yes.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah. So
taking all the boobs and asses out of it is still pretty neat.
And I would keep the boobs and asses in it.
I mean, but it's still a cool show even if you took all of the scantily clad women out.
I've always been a fan of like Cirque du Soleil and all of that stuff. And the paranormal aspect of it was great. I loved it. I loved that you walked in and you just walked through this like haunted house thing, and that all of those people in that haunted house are also in the show. Like it was a whole
thing. Like the dude that did the metal barrel was attached to me because you know, I always get screwed with
So okay, but anyways, Paranormal Cirque, if it comes to your town, highly recommend. This episode we're going to be talking about just a bunch of places in Italy.
You guys can't see it, but she's wearing socks that perfectly mimic how she is today.
And oh, it's Patrick.
It's Patrick drooling, going, what? That's literally what you looked like this morning waking up.
Yeah, I know. Because someone's feeder went off because the batteries were dying. It was like the smoke alarm all over again. Was not great. So anyways, we're going to be talking about Villa De Vecchi, the Capuchin Catacombs, Villa Magnoni, and Palazzo Dario. So they're just quick hitters, but I mean...
You guys are adding some accents to these. Dario.
Well, you can do that, because I am not...
I'm fluent in Italian. I played Assassin's Creed, okay?
Okay. Okay. Oh my god. Okay, so we're starting off with Villa De Vecchi. just east of Lake Como, nestled against the forested mountains of Cortanova, sits a house that's said to be haunted. Villa De Vecchi, alternately nicknamed the Red House, Ghost Mansion, and Casa del Streghe, which is the House of Witches, was built between 1854 and 1857 as the summer residence of Count Felix De Vecchi. Within a few short years of its completion, the house witnessed an inexplicable string of tragedies that would forever cement its Gothic legacy. Count Felix De Vecchi was head of the Italian National Guard and a decorated hero following Milan's liberation from Austrian rule in 1848. A well-read and widely traveled man, the Count set out to build a dream retreat for his family with the help of architect Alessandro Sidoli. Alessandro Sidoli died a year before the villa was completed, and many would later view his death as the first ill omen. Nevertheless, the Count and his family made Villa De Vecchi their home during the spring and summer months, and by most accounts led an idyllic, if brief, existence. Set within a 130,000 square meter park, the great mansion boasted a blend of Baroque and classical Eastern styles and was outfitted with all the modern conveniences of the time, including indoor heating pipes, dumbwaiters, and a large-scale pressurized fountain. The walls and ceilings were decorated with a painstakingly detailed frescoes and friezes, and a larger-than-life fireplace presided over the main parlor, where a grand piano stood at the ready. Extensive gardens and promenades rounded out the already picturesque surroundings, and an equally impressive staff house was built. I will never have a dumbwaiter in a house. If there's a dumbwaiter in a house, I'm not living in it.
Well, obviously, one, we would never be able to afford that. And no, dumbwaiters are...
they're dangerous.
From a mechanical standpoint, no, I would never.
No. And especially not with cats, because I just have... they would... no. Nope.
Sometime in 1862, the Count returned home to find his wife brutally murdered and daughter missing. The Count put out a lengthy, unsuccessful search for his daughter before committing suicide that same year. The villa was then passed on to Felix's brother, Biagio, whose later renovations oversaw the removal of much of the estate's eastern aspects. Biagio and his family continued to live on the grounds up until World War II, after which they vacated for good. The house made the rounds of owners and prospective buyers, but by the 1960s was left permanently uninhabited. While the natural elements began their assault early on, the majority of the abandoned house's irreversible damage has been done by humans. Graffiti covers the walls, and anything capable of being vandalized has been given its due makeover. Bad boy occultist Aleister Crowley allegedly spent a few nights at the villa in the 1920s, which naturally led to a rise in fan pilgrimages.
I'm only cutting so much out, so you better get it together.
Oh, you're cutting a lot of this out. Which naturally led to a rise in fan pilgrimages. Such an odd word. Rumors of ritualistic orgies, sacrificed, both human and animal, suicides and murders abound. The grand piano, once said to be played at night by a ghostly entity, has since been smashed to pieces, though some locals claim the music can still be heard coming from the house. Despite all natural and human efforts to bring about its demise, Villa De Vecchi persists. An avalanche in 2002 wiped out all the nearby houses while the villa remained untouched. You do know who Aleister Crowley is.
Yes, he wrote...
The Satanic Bible.
Yes.
Ozzy Osbourne has a whole song.
Yes. Okay, so know before you go, if you ever go to Italy, or if you're there. First and foremost, technically going into the house is trespassing. A few tattered signs will tell you as much, so be mindful. Daylight hours are best for visiting, and not just because of the things that go bump in the night. The house really is at its most viewable and, for safety's sake, navigable during the day. Second, and maybe even more importantly, the house is falling apart and faster than ever. Recently, one of the upper floors gave out, taking a woman with it. The stairs are rapidly deteriorating, and bits of ceiling regularly rain down. Hard hats and knee pads aren't necessarily a must, but be cautious and maybe avoid the upper levels altogether. Last but far from least, please be respectful of the house and its surroundings. Villa De Vecchi is a truly magnificent piece of architecture and a unique example of one man's vision that surpassed typical McMansion standards.
Oh, the McMansions. Yes, yeah. I know their food chain very well. The McDonald's.
So, if you ever go, just be mindful, be respectful, obviously.
Don't trespass.
Don't trespass either. I wouldn't go. We're not going to.
Like, urban exploring is neat and all, but like.
Yeah, no. So.
It's all fun and games till you have plaster and stone land on you and kill you, and then nobody's going to know. It's like.
I got that a little bit of information about Villa De Vecchi from atlasobscura.com. So next is the Capuchin Catacombs. And this is all Italian, so if I say something wrong, sorry. Because I don't speak Italian. And he doesn't speak Italian either, no matter how much he says.
I've played Assassin's Creed. I know how to speak Italian. And any listener that has played Assassin's Creed will agree.
Oh. Okay.
We all know Ezio Auditore de Da Vinci. Everybody knows him. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Have an assassin snail named Ezio.
Well, yeah. He's not very good at his job, so he's not very Ezio.
No, he's not. He's not very big, so. Okay. The official name of the Capuchin monks is Order of Friars Minor Capuchin. They are a major order within the Catholic Church and one of the most notable offshoots of the Franciscan order. The Capuchin Order was officially founded in 1520 when a Franciscan friar named Matteo de Bassio claimed that he had received a vision from God, indicating that the Franciscan Order was living in a way other than what their founder, Saint Francis of Assisi, had intended. He founded the Capuchin Order in an effort to return to the solitude and penance that had been practiced by monks in the past. Naturally, the church sought to suppress these changes, so Matteo and his companions had to flee. They would eventually find refuge with the Camaldolese monks, adopting as their official garb cloaks with hoods, as was customary of hermits in that region of Italy. Eventually, in 1528, the Pope gave Matteo his blessing to move forward with this new order of monks, and so the rules of the order were officially drawn up. The life of a Capuchin monk was one to be of extreme poverty. Observant monks were allowed no possessions, nor were they allowed to even touch money. Instead, they would get what they needed to survive through begging. However, not long after its official founding, the Capuchin order hit a few speed bumps when two of its founders left, including Matteo himself. There was a time when the future of this order was uncertain, but ultimately they overcame and the Capuchin order was accepted into mainstream Catholicism.
When you say the Italian names, you gotta...
Yeah.
You gotta do the hand motion. So let's fast forward a little bit and jump over to Palermo. It was late in the 16th century and the Sicilian chapter of the Capuchin order had run out of space in their graveyard. To make better use of the space they had at their disposal, they decided to build catacombs instead. Once the subterranean chamber had been completed, bodies of dead friars began to pile up down there. Before being laid to rest, they were drained of their fluids, washed with vinegar, and when necessary, stuffed straw to help maintain their shape. From there, they were dressed in their normal friars' robes and lay on clay shelves. Originally, these catacombs were intended only for the deceased members of the Capuchin order. But as time went on, it became a morbid symbol of status to be buried here. People of prominence who intended to be entombed within the Capuchin catacombs would write sections in their will explaining how they wished to be dressed, sometimes even specify the frequency with which their clothes were to be changed. That's creepy.
Yeah.
By the 1800s, the catacombs ran on donations from relatives of the deceased. Continued donations would ensure that the deceased remained in a favorable position within the catacombs. If the flow of donations ever stopped, the bodies would actually be moved into less favorable parts of the catacombs, tucked away in corners, up on out-of-sight shelves, etc. Apparently, the Capuchin monks were allowed to touch money again at this point. So, they were, like, extorting people for money.
So that they could be buried in these.
So they could be not buried, to be
entombed,
to be kept there in the way that they wanted to.
Yes.
Because it's like, hey, you know, you give us a couple grand a year, we'll make sure that Grandpa got a nice suit on him and is on a shelf where it's not too musty or dark.
Yeah. So that's why they were allowed to touch money, because they were like, hey.
You're not allowed to touch money unless you're extorting people.
Oh, God. The last friar to be entombed here was in 1871, but burials of the members of the public continued until 1920. Today, the final body count here is about 8,000, plus another 1,252 mummies. The halls of the catacombs are divided into 7 sections: men, women, virgins, children, priests, monks, and professionals. The site had been an object of public fascination for hundreds of years, so was eventually opened to tourists. Now there are catacombs all over Europe: Paris, Rome, Lisbon, the list goes on. But the Capuchin catacombs of Palermo are special because the Capuchins here had a particularly heightened sense of respect and obligation to the dead, minus the extortion. If you visit the catacombs of Paris or Rome, which we have talked about, the catacombs in Paris.
Yep.
All you will see is a pile of bones. But here, you are going to see full bodies on display as if part of a presentation. As long as you pay your dues, apparently. To make matters creepier, there was a particular chemical procedure used here to protect the skin of the deceased from the onslaught of bacteria that normally sped up the decomposition process. Coupled with the unusually dry climate of Palermo, and bodies that would have rotted and decomposed within 9 months, ended up lasting for hundreds of years. Today, most of the bodies are withering away to dust, but there are few notable exceptions, and even less well-preserved specimens are likely to have kept some combination of their skin, teeth, and/or hair. The most famous body down here is that of a 2-year-old girl named Rosalia Lombardo. Though she died in 1920, she looks completely undisturbed by the sands of time. Her face looks as peaceful as the day she died, which has earned her the nickname Sleeping Beauty. And when I was, oh God.
Is there a picture of it?
Oh my God. It is so creepy. Hold on. I'm going to pull it up.
Obviously the,
cause she's in like a glass tomb or something like that.
Obviously the Victorian era, like monarchs and stuff like that didn't know about this, considering they were eating all the mummies from Egypt.
Yes. Oh, see, like you Google a picture and it's,
that's pretty sketchy.
Yeah. It's like, oh, there's a better one of somebody like looking at her. Like she looks like a baby doll.
Interesting.
It's really creepy. I can post these pictures on Instagram, hopefully, but they're cropped out on Google, so if hopefully the post doesn't get taken down with that picture in it, but hey, we'll see. Oh, also, I had to make a new Instagram, so make sure you go follow it. Anyways, I got this about the Capuchin Catacombs off of petersbigadventure.com.
So next we're going to talk about Villa Magnani.
Magnani.
Cana is a town located a few kilometers from Ferrara, a place known mainly for the presence of the Santa Ana Hospital. There's actually also a destination of great interest for all fans of legends and mysteries, Villa Magnani, a mansion abandoned by all, which no one intends to approach. Hard to think how anyone can give it new life, considering the horrible stories that revolve around it. Cana is a small village located in the Provenza di Ferrara. Villa Magnani has brought here numerous tourists who are passionate about horror stories over the years. The mansion has been abandoned for a long time. The main part consists of a residential structure to which some stables are added. Adding a gloomy touch is the garden, in which the vegetation grows pristine. There are, therefore, all the standard elements of a haunted house. For the serenity of the premises, Villa Magnani rises in an area distant from the other houses. To the delight of horror fans, however, it happens to be one step away from a dense forest. There are numerous legends surrounding the structure. The main and most terrifying is given below.
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about. So, the Witch of Villa Magnoni. One of the most famous stories among those related to the famous villa tells the presence of an alleged witch inside the dwelling. According to popular narratives, in fact, the residents of the village of Kona would be the object of a real curse hurled in ancient times by a hag. The curse would envelop the entire building, from which it seems it is possible to hear screams and harrowing laments.
Laments.
The myth has it that the witch decided to take revenge on a group of bored boys who, for fun, wanted to set foot in the villa. The story is not ancient, but dates back to the 80s. After wandering around the garden, they entered the house, immediately hearing the sound of a baby's cry. The group quickly fled, finding themselves in the dense vegetation in total isolation. The baby's cry was audible, and looking up, the boys saw an old woman at the upstairs window. This, the witch guardian of the villa, began to inveigh against them, ordering them to abandon the estate. Escaped by car, the young people were the victim of an accident a short distance from the villa. Only one of four survived, telling the police what happened. A short time later, he moved with his family to another region, while the authorities decided to have the villa's entrance and windows bricked up so as to dissuade others from putting themselves in danger in an abandoned and unsafe structure.
Now we're going to talk about the new owner.
Yeah, which, I mean, you shouldn't be putting yourself in danger. And as much as we talk about them, you shouldn't go in abandoned buildings.
The sad story certainly does not facilitate the buying and selling process of Villa Magnoni, whose owner seems elusive to say the least. Years ago, a local entrepreneur repeatedly tried to buy the structure. The idea was probably to give it new life and at the same time to exploit the legend to attract tourists. In no way, however, he managed to get in touch with the owner or his eventual heirs. It seems the villa was later given to the management of the Italian Red Cross. It is not known whether by expropriation or following a regular sale. However, no one has dared to exploit it in any way for many decades.
Well, that's probably a good thing. Cause
I wonder if they gave it to the Red Cross to make it either like a training center or like a hospital or something.
Probably. I don't know. But I got that story off of an Italian website. I don't know. It's en.italiani.it. So it's very, very Italian. And then I just added this story in to make it a little bit longer. And it's called Palazzo Dario. It's a really big building. I'm not sure. I saw the story and thought it was cool. So we're going to tell you about it. Woo. Okay. Palazzo Dario, a strange curse. The fate that has allegedly followed most of its owners in Venice, and even some that have stayed there, is attributed to a curse. A lot of these places in Italy are just cursed.
Well, everything's old.
Yeah.
So
it is in direct contradiction with the beauty of the place, which it is really pretty. This 500-year-old palace, also known as Ca Dario, has over the centuries been said to have claimed a host of unlucky victims, including the rich and famous. The perpetuated story goes that the people who owned the building or stayed there for more than 20 days died, committed murder, or became bankrupt. Even local fishermen avoided casting their ropes by the cursed palazzo, which has been locally dubbed the house that kills. So location. The Palazzo Dario is located on the Grand Canal in the district of Dorsoduro. Situated towards the southern end of the canal, it is close to the, Guggenheim Museum? That's how I'm going to say that. Guggenheim? and positioned between the Palazzo Barbo Wolkoff and the narrow Rio de Torricelle. It's a lot of Italian, my
It's God. Rio della.
Oh, della. Della, sorry. Palazzo Dario can be viewed from across the Grand Canal opposite the Vaporetto stop, S. Maria del Giglio. Alternatively, you can view the back of the building and its wonderful chimneys from the garden of the Peggy Guggenheim Museum. The palace is greatly admired for its beautiful architectural and decorative features and its iconic inverted cone-shaped chimney pots made to minimize sparks. I don't know what that looks like, so. The palace was built in the Venetian Gothic style, and the facade later renovated into Renaissance style with beautiful circular medallions and marbles. I've seen a picture of it. It's pretty, but it's also big.
Well, yeah, it's a palazzo.
Good job.
Which means palace.
Okay.
Because I speak Italian. It is reputed to be built over an ancient Templar cemetery, and due to a settling of the foundation, is visibly slightly tilted to the right. The palace was remodeled after 1486, said to be by a follower of Pietro Lombardo, for the patrician Giovanni Dario, secretary to the Venetian Senate, diplomat, and merchant. At the base of the building is the inscription, Verbis Guinness John Darius, meaning John Dario, patron of the city, relating to the fact that in 1479 he managed to negotiate a peace with the Turks. After Dario's death in 1494, it was passed to his daughter, Marietta, who was married to Vincenzo Barbaro, the son of Giacomo Barbaro and the owner of the neighboring Palazzo Barbaro Wolkoff. Marietta's son received possession of the house in 1522. Before that time, the Senate rented it on occasion as a residence for Turkish diplomats. The rear of the palazzo can be seen from a small square shaded by trees. The Campiello Barbaro, named in honor of the patrician Barbaro family who lived there.
The English art critic John Ruskin was particularly entranced with and wrote about the palace's Gothic marble-encrusted oculi. The rear facade on the palace of the Campiello Barbaro has Gothic arches of the fifth order. A large project of renovation was undertaken at the end of the 19th century when the palace belonged to the Countess de la Baume-Pluvenel, a French aristocrat and writer who was using the name Laurent Everard. The Countess was responsible for the staircase, the external chimneys, the Majolica stoves, and the fine carvings, vaguely reminiscent of the Scuola di San Rocco, in the dining room on the second piano nobile. Looking down to the garden, as well as a great deal of stabilization and replacement of the marble on the facade. She surrounded herself with French and Venetian writers, one of whom, Henri de Regnier, is commemorated by an inscription on the garden wall. It reads, In questa casa antica de Dario Henri de Regnier, poeta di Francia. I don't know what that says. Venezimenti visi e scrisse. Annie, 1899 to 1901.
I think you're on the money.
Okay.
I think you're pretty close.
Okay. Whew. That was a lot. In 1908, Claude Monet used the building as a subject for a series of Impressionist paintings. Ca' Dario is often described as a characteristic Venetian palace, often compared to the Ca' d'Oro. Ca' Dario Palace caught the attention of John Ruskin, who described the decorations in his famous The Stones of Venice. D'Annunzio also describes it as crooked as a courtesan bent under the pump of his jewelry. I guess because it's not even anymore.
Yeah, it's
it fell. The building in 2015 is private and not normally open to the public. However, an agreement between the current owner and the Venetian Art Museum Peggy Guggenheim Collection makes it available for special art exhibitions.
Now we're going to talk about the strange curse.
Yes. And why it's cursed, I guess.
The house was built in 1479 for aristocrat Dario. His daughter, Marietta, and her husband, Vincenzo, later inherited the house. Vincenzo was stabbed to death, and Marietta died by suicide in the Grand Canal not long after. Shortly after these tragedies, their son, Vincenzo Jr., was killed in Crete by assassins. The cursed house claimed another victim when British scientist Radon Brown became its owner. After having the house for only 4 years, he suffered financial difficulties, and his romantic relationships with another man was discovered. The scandal affected him so much that in 1842, he died by suicide in the palace with his partner. Some speculate that the deaths were a murder-suicide. Charles Briggs, an American millionaire, met a similar end. After purchasing the palazzo, he was accused of being gay and fled to Mexico, where his lover died by suicide. The property then remained empty for the first half of the 20th century. In 1964, the world-famous operatic tenor Mario Delmonico entered negotiations to buy the property. However, on his way to Venice to sign the contract, he was involved in a serious car accident that made him rethink his decision on buying the building. Then in the 1970s, the Count of Turin bought Palazzo Dario and was murdered by his lover, Raoul Blasek, who later died a violent death after fleeing to London.
It's not, like, funny. I'm not, like, laughing at it, but, like...
The fact that all the men...
All of them are gay?
All the men that bought it ended up having gay lovers?
Yeah, and except for... I mean, it wasn't mentioned. He might have been gay. The operatic tenor, the Mario, the one who had the car crash. I mean, it wasn't mentioned, but I don't know. So, Kit Lambert, who managed The Who, bought the palace, but it is said he used to stay in a hotel nearby to escape the many ghosts he claimed infested the house. In the 80s, Venetian businessman Fabrizio Ferrari bought the... I just like that name. bought the house and moved there with his sister Nicoletta. He later lost all his assets and his sister died in a car crash. Later that same decade, the financier Raul Gardini bought the place, aiming to give it to his daughter, but after a series of economic setbacks and scandal, he died by suicide in 1993. At the turn of the 21st century, Woody Allen considered buying Palazzo Dario, but changed his mind, allegedly after reading about all the strange and tragic deaths connected to the house. As recently as 2002, The Who's original bass player, John Entwistle, suffered a heart attack a week after renting the palace. Presently, it's owned by an American company. No word yet of any misfortunes. Some locals still believe that the basis for the curse may originate from the fact that the building was constructed over an old Templar cemetery. There is no doubt that whether you believe these stories or not, Palazzo Dario is a beautiful place worth admiring, but perhaps from a distance. And then somebody wrote a poem about the curse of this palace, and I wanted to put it in there.
That I have to read?
That you have to read. Because I thought it was cool that somebody had wrote a poem about it, but hey.
In Venice, where the waters gleam, stands Palazzo Dario, a haunted dream. Its walls whisper tales of woe, of fortunes lost and sorrows flow. Giovanni Dario built with pride a palace by the Grand Canal's side, but shadows crept within its halls, a curse that echoed through its walls. Marietta, his daughter fair, inherited the palace unaware, her life a tragic, twisted tale of loss and love, of hearts that fail. Each owner met a fate so grim, a curse that followed after him. Bankruptcy, death, and a sorrow's kiss, a legacy of dark abyss. The palace stands, a beauty cursed, its history a tale reversed. For those who dare to call it home, find only grief beneath its dome. So if you pass by Venice Fair and see Palazzo Dario there, remember well the curse it keeps and the souls within who forever weep.
Okay, that's kind of sad. Like, that's a really sad poem, but hey. So I got the Palazzo Dario information from imagesofvenice.com. And that's all we have for you on this episode. I'll post pictures on Instagram and Facebook with pictures from all of these places so that you guys can see it.
And remember, stay safe.
Yes.
Stay out of abandoned buildings.
Yes. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, the new email is 3amtalesofterror@gmail.com. You can also reach out on Instagram or Facebook. Currently, that's the only social media that we have, so make sure you go and follow it. Instagram, I had to make a new one, but it is still 3am Tales of Terror, so at 3am Tales of Terror. Facebook page is still there, so yeah, make sure you go check it out. Let us know if you have any story ideas, and other than that, I guess we'll see you next week.
Dun dun.
Dun dun.
Ciao.
Okay, bye.